Did I not?
So, in order to see how we cause stress and suffering, we have to think outside of the normal ways we think. The sort of the obvious, apparent, run-of-the-mill, as the Buddha called it, day-to-day type thinking, which doesn't bring about a lot of enlightenment or insight, surely, to how we author our own stress. There's four things the Buddha said that get in the way of seeing clearly. The first is being driven by our feelings for sensual pleasure. Our gut desires for feeling pleasure, sensual pleasure, and our cravings for it. There's also our views and opinions of, you know, the way things should be. We can get so caught up in them, attached to the way we believe the world should be or the way people should be, our expectations of people, that we can cause ourselves enormous amount of suffering, and we get so caught up in these views and opinions that we don't focus anything, any attention on what our own, the role our own expectations and our own views have caused ourselves stress and a difficulty to adjust. And then, of course, there's our habits and practices, the habitual things that we fall into, the need to always have an iced coffee at 9 or a certain kind of sandwich at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday, or, you know, we have these rituals and routines and practices. We have to go to the gym, and today's Saturday, I have to go. I have to work out, and then I have to go to the flea market, and then I have to. And if any of these things get thrown off, if it's raining, you know, if the gym's closed for repairs, if we get injured and we can't work out, then all catastrophe arises. And we can't really see, because we're so caught up in these rituals being blocked, we can't see how much dependence and how much momentum and karmic influence we've placed on these habits. So, but the fourth one is what I'm going to focus on today, which is Sakkaya Ditti, which is the story we tell about ourselves. That running story we all have in our heads. Yes, you, I'm talking about you. The story of you. The story of me. It's been a hard road, but I've managed to do quite well. Against all odds, I was quite a victim. I was. Somebody once sent me a, this is a long, long time ago, somebody once sent me an application that he wrote for NYU to go to school. And he sent it to me and his AA sponsor and another friend, and none of those other guys read it. They just said, oh, it's fine, it's wonderful, you've written your college application, it's a beautiful thing, you should feel great, you're moving on in your life. And I actually bothered to open it up, and it started out with the lines, my parents were smelly, awful, little Russian peasants that were horrible people, and I was a victim all my life. But thankfully, I've developed the ability to shower now, so I don't smell, at least. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. And I wrote him, I said, don't send this out. And he said, why not? It's the truth. It's my story. I'm like, dude. Your story is not going to get you anywhere. Certainly not going to get you in NYU. It might get you into a shrink's office at an institution, but I call up his sponsor, and I said, dude, you have to read this. And his sponsor, like, called me back a few minutes later and just said, oh, my God. So that'll teach us for blindly saying, oh, it's okay. sometimes you got to be the bad guy. So anyway, yeah, we all carry around a story of, that we tell about ourselves, how we compare with other people, what's going to probably happen to us in the future, what the big dramas in our lives are, what other people think about us, we wonder. We wonder about our reputations, what other people are, how we're regarded in our careers. We worry about, are we being too weak with our boundaries, or are we being too accommodating, or are we being, so we tell these stories about ourselves. And the Buddha said that this, the core of Sakkayadhiti comes from this belief in what he calls atta, which is we believe we have a core identity or self or soul, and we believe that core identity doesn't change. That it's something that's somewhere inside of us. Maybe it's just the size of an almond. Maybe in my case, a walnut. But there's a little part tucked in that brain that's really who I am that makes a connection between all the things I've done in the past and the way I am today. And we believe we have this unchanging core identity. Now, of course, the Buddha, in a famous, famous sutta, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, said, okay, let's observe our experience and see if you can find anything in you that doesn't change, that isn't constantly changing. And eventually the monks realized through long periods of meditation that, in fact, they couldn't find anything. Their thoughts were changing, their feelings were changing, their bodies were changing, their perceptions of the world were changing. The way they sensed the world were changing, everything changes. And when they realize this, they realize, well, yes, on any given moment, I might have a self, I have an identity, I have a name for linguistic purposes so that you know who I am, but this idea that I have this core unchanging thing that never alters, that is always there and gives me an identity that's different from everybody else, this is a fallacy. It's an illusion. Now, we go on once we have this belief and we start telling stories about this little self that we have, this identity, this core being, this soul. And we tell these stories, who it is, what it's all about, why it's so great. Some people, especially those in recovery, tend to be extreme. They can say, they believe at once they're the greatest thing since sliced bread and also a piece of shit. So when we get attached to these stories we tell about ourselves, they can swing wildly from positives to negatives, positives to negatives. It's like being attached to the things that people say about you. Sometimes they'll be wonderful, but if you get attached to them, you're also going to have to be attached when people criticize or speak harshly about you. So when we get caught up in self, we really, really get attached to a lot of stress and suffering, because the stories we tell about ourselves can be things that we stick to, that follow us around and become very, very difficult to shake and can become very, very difficult to break free of and can set really harsh limits. I have a friend who trying to find a job, and when I would talk to him about, well, what is it you want to do? He'd go through all these lists of all the things he can't do. And I was like, wow, you really, if it's up to you, you're really just good for lying in bed, because, you know, but that's what very often, if we listen to what our brains say about us, that's where we wind up heading. So the Buddha said there's no such a thing. And therefore, this whole tendency we have to tell our inner biographies, our autobiographies, to tell, have this running inner story about where we've been, where we're heading, how we're regarded by other people, all this stuff is just a lot of mental fog. And the reason why it's so unskillful is if we go all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, where it said, the core essence of spiritual practice is to see how we're causing ourselves stress and suffering and to stop, right? And to see how we cause ourselves happiness and to do more of whatever that is. Now, if you're walking around with this idea of, well, I've got this identity, and this identity does certain things, you're not going to be able to simply let go of those things because you're going to believe that's who you are. If, for example, you believe that you're not good at music, but you're very good with the visual arts, then you probably will never allow yourself to sing out loud in a setting where other people sing. But you might feel very comfortable drawing in front of people. We become very compartmentalized, and we limit ourselves. And in a very real way, when it comes time to see how we're causing ourselves stress and suffering, for example, if we have too high expectations of ourselves, then when we see that, then we immediately say, but no, I'm a perfectionist. That's just the way I am. I can't change because I'm a perfectionist. This telling a story about ourselves creates all these sticky, as one Buddhist monk referred to as stickiness. I think even the Buddha referred to self as like just your entire skin is sticky and everything sticks to it. Everything that we think is ourselves becomes very difficult to let go of. We become trapped. And then when we see that something is causing us suffering, for example, we can see that we have too much emphasis upon our finding happiness in our careers, or finding happiness in a relationship, or finding happiness in our families, or finding happiness in some area. But then the story of ourself creeps up again. And just when we say, oh, I'm putting too much emphasis on finding happiness in my career, but then yourself says, well, but that's how I define myself. I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. I'm a this or I'm a that. And if I let go a little, then my very sense of who I am starts to fall apart. Now, the Buddha was all in favor of using self very, very lightly, strategically, but not holding on to it. Interestingly enough, 2,200 years after the Buddha died, a great Western philosopher came to the exact same conclusion. A guy named David Hume. He was a skepticist. He was Scottish. He lived up until the 1760s. And around 1740, he wrote a book called A Treatise on Human Nature, where one of the big conclusions is, guess what? We don't have a self. We don't have an identity. All we've got are these changing things, changing thoughts, changing sensations, changing perceptions. And every Buddhist around the world at the time hopefully went, we knew that for 2,200 years. But still, it was a momentous moment, a very, very huge break in Western philosophy. The idea that this soul, this identity that people have been saying is the most important thing to take care of and to get to know thyself, keep track of yourself. All this selfing, suddenly Hume said, the reason why we create this self, this lasting identity, is because, he said, we're not attentive. We don't watch closely. We don't see that all of the perceptions and sensations and thoughts are slightly different. They're always changing. We don't pay attention very well, so all the thoughts and sensations, they seem kind of similar. The thoughts I had on today seemed like very similar to the thoughts I had yesterday, and they were sort of similar to the thoughts I had this weekend. But actually, they're subtly changing. If you have the great misfortune of hearing yourself give a talk and a tape from years ago, which I do, and you hear the person that you were even 5 years ago, the first emotion I guarantee you that will rise is, oh my God, who is that person? Perhaps you have a diary or something like that, and you'll have read the things that are important, the thoughts that you have, and the first impression is, I don't know this person. But if I do know this person, I know them vaguely, but they're not really me. And that's really the core of it. Other philosophers, after after Hume, like Husserl said the exact same thing, and Derrida said basically, it's all an illusion, this thing we carry around, the story. And that Husserl said we have to let go and just focus on the real things that are happening right now. And as the Buddha said, we have to see which ones are useful and which ones aren't useful. Rather than thinking in terms of which things are me and which things aren't me, think in terms of which things I do cause happiness and which things I do cause stress. There's no need to bring I or me into it anymore. It's simply which actions are skillful and which actions aren't. Now, you might object, but Josh, you say. You don't actually say that, but for the sake of continuing, I say, but Josh, you say, what of Descartes and his famous Renaissance statement, I think, therefore I am? Well, every subsequent philosopher has noticed the big flaw in that argument. In case you don't know what it is, it's very simple. Just because there are thoughts doesn't mean there is an I. Saying I think, therefore I am, equates the idea that if there are thoughts, there must be an I or a singular element responsible for these thoughts. But that's not true. Your head is just the place where a lot of thoughts happen, but there's no I. There's no you creating them. What do I mean? Let me give you an example. This is an example I thought of as I was walking from work to here. And so it'll probably be pretty lame. But if there was a suggestion box in a large company, and the suggestion box had cards and a pen, and they'd asked everybody to make suggestions, by the end of the month, you open up the suggestion box and there's all these cards with all these different suggestions. Now, somebody from Mars might look at that box and say, well, that box is a very smart mind because it's got all these ideas. But you would say, no, a whole bunch of different people wrote on cards and just put their ideas in that box. Guess what that box is? That's your brain. It's a place where a lot of people have shoved a lot of ideas. And then one day, they all started coming out, and you said, wow, that suggestion box is really smart. I'm a smart cookie. But it's not you. It's just the box that the world and the people that you surrounded yourself in and all the things you've read and all the people and all the TV shows and all the comic books and the movies and the teachers and the whatnots have shoved a whole lot of suggestions in there. Some of them you never pulled out, and some of them coming out years later, and there's so many years later that you forgot that they weren't yours. So, the mind is like a suggestion box. The problem is we think that there's this little person in that box coming up with all those ideas, but they're not. They're just things that have been placed in there from time past and immemorial past and immemorial past. So, how do we get to the place? How do we simply practice to let go of this storytelling about ourselves, about this core identity, about this personality belief, the Sakkaya Ditti? How do we do this? And the Buddha, of course, said the key is, first of all, in your meditation. To simply have a new relationship with your thoughts, rather than the normal relationship we have with our thoughts, which is, it's in the front of our brain, that's where we live, it's got to be mine because I'm thinking it, it's got to be important, therefore I've got to do it, it's got to be, I have to believe my thoughts because they're mine. Instead, we practice not believing them, not attaching to them, not thinking that they're ours, and instead we simply look at them in terms of, are they skillful? Are they unskillful? Are they causing me stress and suffering right now in my body? Are they causing a sense of ease? If I thought this way all the time, would I be happy or would I be stressed out? Is this thought whispering or shouting? Is this thought skillful or unskillful? There's, after a while, when we meditate enough or we begin to detach a little bit from our thoughts, we begin to realize, as Ajahn Jeff says, that the mind is like a committee, a debating committee, like a large, large committee. There's very skillful voices, the voices of the progressives. There are very angry, loud voices. You've got the Tea Party in your head. You've got all sorts of voices in your head. And the thing is, not to take any of them, even the skillful ones. Don't take any of them to be who you really are. The only thing you really are is the observing quality that can watch these thoughts, see if they're useful or not, and decide whether today you want to give them more energy or not. You don't have to hop aboard a train just because it comes into a train station. If you did, you'd wind up someplace you don't probably belong. Just the same, you don't have to hop aboard every thought that comes into your mind. Because if you do, you're going to wind up someplace you don't belong. Stressed out. Ask yourself when a thought comes into your mind, is this really a thought I want to climb aboard? Because ask yourself where that thought led you last time you climbed aboard it. The thought like, what are they thinking about me? Does she or he like me or not? What's going to happen to me in the future? How can I get more money? All these thoughts, ask yourself, and notice, if you do climb aboard these trains of thought, ask yourself to at least notice, are they taking you anywhere good? Or are they taking you anywhere bad? So the next time they come into the train station of your mind, look how many analogies I've got today. It's just staggering. I'm just like a mini Buddha today with my analogies. I should come up with a list. I could be doing all the things he did so well. Anyway, so that's my rambling talk on Sakkaya Ditti, the dangers, how it gets in the way of seeing clearly. All the various philosophers that wrote about it, why we do it, and how to let go. So thank you for listening. Now it's your time to ask any questions or share anything you'd like. Hi.
Hi. So what is that observing quality then, and where does it reside?
Okay. What is the observing quality, and where does it reside? Well, neurobiologically, it resides in your cingulate, which is actually a part of the brain that is known as the neuroscientists call it the executive secretary of the mind. The frontal lobe is actually where we make all our decisions, and the amygdala is where we have all our emotions, and the insula is where we have the body sensations. But there's this one little part of the mind that if we really let go of putting too much energy into attaching to thoughts or sensations or body sensations in the parietal lobe, there's a little part of the mind called the cingulate, and its job is simply to observe, to see what's going on, to consult and ask if the things that are asking for attention are worth it or not. Now, that's just the neurobiological answer, but the spiritual answer is in your body. That's why in the meditation we go into the body. We find a place what some monks call the heart, or they can call it the rupa, or just a place below the head, which is where we can reside when we want to watch the thoughts. We begin to almost physicalize the space where the thoughts occur, and we can, over time in practice and meditation, literally begin to have a sense that I'm not in the exact same place as my thoughts. That's why we practice in meditation going into the body, and going lower and lower and lower and finding a place where we can be with the breath. Because what we're doing is not only cultivating a safe place, but it's a place where we can watch the thoughts and watch all the sensations and watch all the perceptions without getting so pulled in. But most of the time we live right behind our eyes. And that also happens to be almost exactly the same place where we physicalize our thoughts. We tend to think our thoughts are somewhere in here. And when we live right behind our eyes, it feels like I am these thoughts that are happening. But if through yoga and meditation and through the practice of becoming more in the body, you have this place where you can reside in, at least part of your awareness, we don't get sucked in. So it's a sense of, in one sense, it's simply a different part of the brain being utilized that normally is underutilized, but in another sense, it's a grounding of the awareness in the body so that we don't get tugged by all the stuff that happens in here. There's a sense of always keeping the stomach relaxed, the chest relaxed, the shoulders relaxed, the breathing comfortable. And by doing this, we're grounding ourselves and keeping someplace free and safe from all this storytelling and noise and beliefs about ourselves. Every time we become grounded again, we detach a little bit from those stories. Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thank you. Hi.
Hi. So your teaching today is very liberating because I say, all that other stuff, I can, all the stories I've been telling myself about myself, I can leave them behind and I can do whatever I want. Fantastic. To put my concern in the greatest form, my perception of myself is something that brought me here and has led me to believe I have told myself that I am someone who seeks out spiritual practice, who wants to do things like this. And so I don't want to throw everything out, right? I want to keep things that are, I don't think there's a question for me.
No, what you're actually hinting at is very, very, very important, and it's actually very, very skillful. It's a very, very adept question. The Buddha in the Dhammapada, before he gets to the chapter on letting go of self, there's an earlier chapter called the self, which he says, be skillful with it. And that's exactly what you're referring to. While we're working with the idea of having an identity, make it a very skillful identity, as in, I'm a meditator, I'm a spiritual person, I'm a helpful person, I'm not somebody who's caught up in solely in material things. I'm interested in growing through practice. Now, that's a great story, that's a very skillful story, but the problem is if you cling on to it, if you hold on to it, there's going to be times, A, where you don't, in the future, you're not going to need to tell that story. It's going to be excess baggage. It's like you're carrying around all this baggage that at one point was useful when you were living in the desert. You carried around a fan. But then you've walked all the way to someplace that's cool, and if you're still carrying around this heavy fan, you know, it's not useful anymore. So carrying around the thoughts, I'm a skillful, meditative, spiritual practitioner, is great to keep us motivated and to keep us coming for a long period. Certainly I've used it, and every single practitioner I know uses that story. But then there comes a time to drop it. And that's why the Buddha said the core of right view is knowing that even right view itself has to be dropped. That's where Buddhism is so different in a way, along with its view of not self. It's the Buddha said, everything I've taught you, at one point you're going to have to be willing to put down, because when you get to a place where you're so skillful and so calm at times during meditation, walking around and reciting the Four Noble Truths, or that I'm a skillful meditator, or I'm this or I'm that, it's unnecessary. So it's only when we need it we carry around these stories. The second thing is also, in my experience, which I certainly fell into as a young person that was into Buddhism, and then as I became, you know, a heavy practitioner, and then later on got became a teacher, is there's this tendency to tell a story like, oh, I'm Mr. Buddhist, and then your friends go, oh, can't we just have a Saturday night? Why do we have to hear about this? And it's absolutely true. That's one of the things that I talked with my co-teacher years ago, Craig Slager, and he went to hang out with our teacher, Ajahn Jeff, and he went out to a retreat in the desert where he was going to be out in the desert with the monks for 7 days a week in the desert. And the only books he brought were translations of the Buddhist teaching. And his teacher, Ajahn Jeff, who did the translations, it was his translations, said, yo, well, he didn't say yo because he's not the kind that says yo, but he said, are you sure you want to just bring that? Like, maybe a mystery novel, you know, some kind of like, you know, you're somebody who lives in the city most of your life. You're going to go out now in 7 days of quiet isolation, and you're going to, you know, you're telling yourself a story about yourself of being Mr. Meditator, Mr. Teacher, and I guarantee you when you hit 4 days, you're going to hit a wall, and you're not going to want to read any more of these Buddhist books. You're going to want to have like something that where you can just literally relax for a while and not have to carry around the story of being the spiritual guy. Craig, of course, was like, no. He told me 2 days in he was stark raving mad. He was like walking miles to find a Jesuit who was meditating to borrow one of their books. It's just like, I cannot do this. So, that's another reason. Because, you know, if we tell ourselves, I'm Mr. Spiritual, then what are you going to do the days when the only thing you want to do is watch the last episode of Lost and, you know, kibitz with your friend about what you thought about it, you know? Not that that's terrible. I mean, I watched it, but I mean, I'm just saying, we can't get caught up in these stories. Use them when you need to, but don't hold on to them, because when you hold on to anything, especially a story about yourself, it's eventually going to bite you in the ass.
Thank you.
Hey, Phil.
Hey, Josh. How's it going? I'm me.
At least right now.
I hate to do this to you, but I wanted to say thanks for the analogy of before you said when you're meditating, and you said when you take in the breath, don't think of it as breathing in and breathing out, but breathe in, and then that breath is actually going out into the body. And it actually helped me while I was meditating to feel like I was inside my body, not in my head, for the breath to come in this way and then go out. So that was really great. Just wanted to say thanks for that.
Thank you. A lot of monks talk, where I've sat with, talk about don't even believe that the breath is just coming in through your mouth. Feel it like coming in through your entire body. And then feel it like dissipating out from your body. So there's just this feeling of it coming in and out through you, but it's not this sense, because you'll still be breathing in through your nose, but the less you centralize it and make it more a sensation of just passing through you, the more embodied you become and the more relaxed you become. Thank you. Hi. It's a great question. The question is, while we're trying to let go of the stories we carry around or about ourselves, what do we do when, say, our families or coworkers or our friends have this story or this view of who we are?
And they, like, tell other people.
And they keep you in a box while you're trying to let go of the box, where your friends, your family, you know, co-workers, people you know, can be carrying around a story that may have been true for a brief period of time at one point in your life, but is no longer true now. But which is one of the reasons why, by the way, Buddhists are almost the first people in every country to go work with people who have been convicted of murder and serious crimes, because Buddhists don't believe that simply because somebody's done something that they are condemned to that small identity, that there is always change possible. There's a couple of different ways to answer that. The first is that the Buddha said whenever we get overly concerned with what people say about us, we're heading down the road to suffering anyway. So from the very beginning, the moment you are concerned about your reputation or about what people are saying about you, what they say about you to yourself, you're attaching to something that you have no control over, nor will you ever have any control over. You really, really will never be able to reach into somebody's mind and change the setting so that they regard you as the truly wonderful, skillful person that you are. You know, there are always going to be people out there. The Buddha said there's always going to be somebody out there that's going to think ill, talk ill. And if we make our happiness contingent upon making everybody in the world love us, or just a few people who don't, you know, think everything highly about us, make sure everything they say is what we want, we'll never be happy. The true happiness has got to come from within. Now, with that said, the Buddha said, too, that, you know, we should find wise spiritual practitioners, because the brain, even if we remember that we shouldn't make our sense of our worth dependent on other people, we should still remember that the brain takes in a lot anyway, no matter how vigilant we are. So the best thing to do is to, as many times as you can, surround yourself with spiritual people who are not the kind of people who hold grudges. And in the Buddhist teachings to lay practitioners, he says, even people that you think you're stuck with, like your family, your relationships, if you know, they are unskillful, if they're telling you stories about yourself that are harmful, you don't have to accept it. You don't have to believe it, take it in. You don't have to even be there. You can end that conversation. There's a famous teaching of the Buddha's that Ajahn Amaro reminded me of this weekend, which I used to tell all the time, and it's worth remembering. There's a famous story of the aggressor whose son had converted, and the guy had already lost a lot of his family to the Buddha's teachings, and finally lost his eldest son, and this was a catastrophe. He wanted his son to take over the business, so he goes to the Buddha and he starts shouting all these things about the Buddha that are really insults. He says, "You're worthless, you're terrible, all you're doing is taking all the good children and turning them into these monks that, you know, carry bowls, you know, look what a crappy guy you are, blah, blah, blah." It was just really insulting the Buddha. And the Buddha just stood there and smiled. And finally, when the guy ran out of breath, the Buddha said, "Well, let me ask you a question. Do you ever have people over to your house?" And the aggressor said, "Well, yeah, all the time. I have people over to my house." "Sure, why are you asking me that?" And the Buddha said, "Well, when you have people over to your house, do you offer them food?" And the aggressive guy, the mean-spirited guy, said, "Of course I offer my guests food. What do you think?" And the Buddha said, "Well, when you offer your guests food, are there some guests who don't accept it, who don't eat it, what you offer, because they've already eaten?" And the aggressor said, "Well, yeah, there are people who don't eat what I offer. Sometimes that happens." And the Buddha said, "Well, whose food is it then?" And the guy said, "Well, it's my food then, of course." And the Buddha said, "Just so. I don't accept your words, so they're yours. Your anger is your anger. Has nothing to do with me. If they're carrying around stories about you that you don't like, or views that you don't like, don't eat them." Really. don't eat them. They're just poison. And they're eventually going to become so poisonous to the minds of the people who carry them that either they'll suffer or B, they'll let them go. But either way, you don't have to get involved. It's really, you know, it's sort of a little bit setting the bar pretty high to say sometimes, you know, we should never bother explaining ourselves. But if you do explain yourself, there comes the real spiritual act is explain it and let it go and don't try to control the results. Say your view and then that's it. Let them have whatever view they want. It's when we really try to force them to our view of ourselves and why they should think that, you know, we're not at fault or we're wonderful, whatever, that's when the real stress and the upset happens. And if we simply cultivate the ability to let go, not eat other people's opinions of us, not eat what they say about us, we live much, much happier lives. So I hope that answered your question. All the way in the back.
All right. It's kind of long, but I guess I'll read it to you. I know we are not condemned by our actions, but some people, I feel, deserve to be condemned by their actions. And I want to get over this hate that I have towards selfish people. Because I know what it's like to be selfish. I've been selfish, and I've been a disgusting liar, but I'm not as disgusting as them, and I feel like that makes me better. But I want to get over it because I do feel like everybody deserves joy. Even though sometimes, like, I feel like they don't deserve it. In fact,